Today's episode is sponsored by Morgan Stanley. Just 30 years ago, renewable energy seemed futuristic. Now, it's a practical way to power cities. Morgan Stanley explores the economics driving the industry and what it means for investors. Hear the full podcast at morganstanley.com/podcast. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC. Member SIPC.
Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. This week, we step back and look at the big picture. With Trump's hand on the economy, are we heading over a cliff or cruising along nicely? And are markets impervious to Trump tweets? Or do they know something we don't? And when are we getting another recession? Here to help us figure all of this out is Megan Green. She's chief economist at Manulife Asset Management. She's also an unrepentant Boston Red Sox fan, so we'll try to convince her during this interview of the error of her ways. I should note that we're on the 33rd floor of a building on the east side of Midtown Manhattan, so you might hear some sirens, you might hear some construction, who knows, but we're in the heart of the financial industry, great place to talk about the economy and markets, and seeing around the corner of financial trends is what Megan does for a living, so we're thrilled to have her with us. Megan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. You should just give up on the whole Yankees thing right now, though.
What if the Yankees signed Bryce Harper? Then you could come along to our side. All right, we're not going to go too deep into baseball, but obviously it's a lifelong campaign for me to get Megan away from the Red Sox. I know it'll never happen. All right, so let's just start with the economy. 4.1% growth in the second quarter. Is Trump making America great again or what? Are we just on fire? Should we all just thank President Donald Trump for this great economy we've got?
So no, I would highlight we've had a couple of quarters of growth above 4% since the global financial crisis, over which Donald Trump has presided, you know, over one. So he can't take full credit for this. On the other hand, some of the reason that we've got such growth is because we've got so much fiscal stimulus coming down the line, and we do have Trump to thank for that, although I'm not sure we should really be thanking him for that. In the short term, that's really goosed growth and will continue to do probably till the end of next year. And then it tapers off, and in the meantime, we're blowing out our budget deficit. So, you know, there is one aspect of the Q2 GDP growth number that we also need to thank Trump for, but again, in a backhanded way, potentially, and that's the trade piece of Q2 growth. In addition to personal consumption, exports really boosted growth, and part of why exports were so strong, despite a stronger dollar, actually, was that there were a bunch of soy exports, for example, to China and other countries trying to beat the tariffs. So given our trade policy, a bunch of countries were trying to get ahead of them and so increased what they were importing from the U.S. and that boosted growth. Is that going to continue? Unfortunately not. I see estimates that soy alone added 0.5 percentage points to Q2 GDP. So without that, we'd be at 3.6. That's still pretty great, actually. But it's probably as good as it gets. I think that Q2 is the peak, and then we'll probably decelerate and return to our potential GDP growth or around our potential GDP growth rate from here on out, which is going to be around 2%. We won't go straight to 2%. It'll take a while. But unless we fundamentally boost productivity growth or our labor force, I don't see any other way of really boosting our potential GDP.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to stick on GDP for a second and deconstruct a Trump tweet, the one that really sort of got under my skin a little bit, where he said, best part about this GDP report is that our trade deficit went down by X billion, I forget the exact number, with no reference to the fact that it went down because we had that quick speed up in exports ahead of other countries trying to get ahead of retaliatory tariffs. So, like, does Trump have a leg to stand on in terms of how his policies are reducing the trade deficit?
No, he doesn't really. And I think in terms of trying to address bilateral trade deficits, particularly with China, trying to force China to buy more from us, I think that if we were to achieve that, it's not like we're in the part of the business cycle where companies have loads of spare capacity and they're just going to ramp up production and export more to China. Most firms are already at full capacity given we're so late in the business cycle. So they're just kind of diverting trade from elsewhere to then export to China. So net-net, it doesn't have really any impact on the U.S. economy. I'd say bilateral trade deficits are probably the wrong thing to be looking at. I don't really see our trade balances as a huge issue. We have a global reserve currency, so we benefit from that. And as long as that's the case, a current account deficit of 3.5% of GDP is nothing to write home about.
It sounds to me like you're trying to say that President Trump has a fundamental misunderstanding of what the trade deficit is and whether it matters. But he does seem completely fixated on the idea that if we have a trade deficit, we're losing. We lose money to the EU, we lose money to China, Mexico. He's even mentioned Canada, even though we have an overall trade surplus with Canada. If you were going to try to convince President Trump that the trade deficit, the way he talks about it, doesn't matter, in simple terms, how would you do that?
So I would highlight that trade deficits aren't a morality tale. There's no morality that comes into it, either for the U.S., which is running a deficit, or for a country like Germany, which is running a surplus. It's just an accounting definition. And so I would highlight that the narrative goes that these other countries with trade surpluses are really just skiving off of our demand. They're relying on the U.S. as the consumer of last resort. And that gets a lot of play, I think, amongst Joe Sixpack. The problem is that that's not really how these balances work. Everyone shouldn't have a balanced trade balance. We should all be in deficit and surplus because we specialize. It's Econ 101. And introducing tariffs are absolutely not the way to address that at all. In fact, tariffs or any rigidity, subsidies have the same effect. They just add deadweight losses into the economy. So they create winners and losers, but overall, the losers always outweigh the winners if you introduce these rigidities. And so they're kind of a sideshow. Even in this trade spat that we're in, they're still a sideshow. They're certainly not a way to address the current account balance.
Let's talk for a minute about why markets seem to ignore Trump's trade wars. For the most part, obviously there's some dislocation in markets and technology, the FANG stocks going down, separate and apart from what Trump tweets and does about trade. But we've got a tariff war going on with China. Could get worse. We've gone back and forth with the EU. It looks like we won't impose these auto tariffs of 20%, but there's the threat of NAFTA going away, and there's this ongoing threat of Trump slapping huge tariffs on our erstwhile allies. And yet the market, for the most part, just doesn't care. Do you have any sense for why that is?
Yeah, so I think there are two reasons. One is just that investors might be assuming that this is sort of art of the deal negotiating by Trump, and they don't really believe that he's going to push it through. I happen to think that these trade wars will get worse before they get worse. So I disagree with that view, but I have spoken to a lot of investors who feel that way. The other reason I think is due to market structure. So about 60% of U.S. equities traded now are traded in passive funds or quanti hedge funds. And none of these look at fundamentals. So I had a conversation recently with the owner of one of these quant hedge funds, and he said, no offense. And by the way, never start a sentence with no offense, because it's going to be offensive. He said, no offense, but why does anybody need economists anymore? And after I got over my offense as an economist, he explained to me, look, we don't need to understand why markets move. We just need to know that they move, because our algos are so fast that basically we just need to figure out what strategies are working at any time and jump into them and then move on. We don't need to know why they're working at all. And it's the same with ETFs to some degree. They're not looking at fundamentals. There's kind of a pile-on effect with ETFs. So if you decide you're going to recreate part of a market structure with ETFs, and then you buy, funds flow into your ETF, then you have to rebalance it because the stock prices went up, and then you end up buying more of it, and you get this piling on effect. It's nothing to do with the fundamentals. So that could also be partly why U.S. equities in particular aren't really responding to every Trump tweet, because the fundamentals don't matter for a lot of these funds, and so they don't really care what Trump is saying in terms of policy, because that's not driving their funds anyhow.
Just to do a couple of quick signposts and definitions for folks who might not do this for a living, we're talking about algos. That's algorithmic trading, trading based on computer programs rather than humans doing a lot of it. And then ETFs are exchange traded funds. All right, markets are basically not reacting to the daily Trump tweets and threats of tariffs and trade. And my assumption is he's now talking about possibly shutting down the government on October 1st when funding runs out. You talk to Republicans on Capitol Hill, they say he'll never actually do it. He's just rattling the saber. He wants to talk about the wall and immigration. But let's say we do get a shutdown. Does that really matter for the economy or markets if we happen to get it?
If we do get a shutdown, I think there will be some market volatility around that. But whether it actually impacts the economy, less so. It depends on how long it lasts. My sense is, given that we're in an election year, it probably won't last that long. Neither the Republicans nor the Democrats will want to be forced to take responsibility for a government shutdown and impact on the economy. So I think if the government were to shut down, it would be resolved fairly quickly. And history shows that when that happens, there's hardly any impact on the economy. The first things that shut down are very obvious things to Joe Sixpack. So national parks are closed, for example, things like that. But the actual impact on the real economy is pretty minimal. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. There should be some market volatility around it, which has been the case in the past as well.
Let's go back to the macroeconomy for a second and the impact of the tax cuts and the deregulation. And I'm thinking about it just because now the White House is talking about perhaps doing a capital gains tax cut through kind of stealth means by gets into the weeds really quickly, but a definitional change that would allow them to reduce capital gains taxes, which mainly impact really rich investors and would give them a lower tax bill. You know, that's on top of the big cut in the corporate tax rate that they've already done and some decrease in marginal tax rates. And you've got the deficit basically exploding and Treasury needing to borrow a whole bunch more money. The White House has said, this is all going to pay for itself with faster growth. Certainly no indication that that's going to happen yet. Talk to me about the sort of longer term prospects for the U.S. if we really are getting these annual trillion-dollar plus deficits. Eventually, one assumes interest rates are going to start to rise and it's really going to come and bite us. Like, what are the risks that we're really just screwing up the fiscal picture right now?
So I think they're pretty high, but they're mitigated by two things. One is that we have the global reserve currency. So that means everybody's always going to want to hold U.S. dollars and invest in U.S. markets. The second reason is that we've got the biggest, most liquid asset class in the world, U.S. treasuries. And so if there's ever a flight to safety, then, you know, money will come pouring into the U.S. So that means we're not going to face an investor strike anytime soon. That being said, we are going to either have to grow our way out from under this debt burden or inflate our way out from under this debt burden at some point. And since the financial crisis, there are a number of reasons we haven't been able to generate any kind of significant inflation. I think it's partly due to the labor market. So we're adding most of our jobs in the sectors that produce what we consume. And these days that it tends to be far and away services, and services producing sectors are really low wage, low hour sectors. So we're adding all our jobs at the bottom of the pay scale. So average hourly earnings aren't being pushed up. We don't get much wage growth, and therefore we don't get much inflation. That makes sense, and I think that will continue to be the case for a while. Also, things like the gig economy, we don't really know how to account for it. So that's also, I think, keeping upper pressure off of wage growth and therefore inflation. It's going to be really hard to generate the kind of inflation that we would need to grow out from under that debt burden. On the growth side, I think the U.S. is kind of a 2% economy. There are two ways that we could break out of that. One is to boost productivity growth. So one way to boost it would be to have more capital expenditure. The tax bill was supposed to maybe encourage some of that, but unfortunately, I think now it's being offset by trade policy. So firms are deferring and delaying any CapEx spending plans. So that net-net averages out to zero. So I don't think we're going to see a big boost in CapEx spending. The other way is technological innovation. Machine learning and artificial intelligence are very exciting, but for all the resources we're throwing at them, we're getting really small incremental gains. I mean, machines still can't tell the difference between a blueberry muffin and a chihuahua, for example. So the tech just isn't that great yet, and one day it will be, but that will take a really long time. And until that happens, we're kind of stuck with low productivity growth. So I just don't see us fundamentally boosting our potential GDP growth to grow out from under this debt burden either. So I do think this debt burden will become a problem. It's just not a short-term problem, and certainly not a problem that will come home to roost within an electoral cycle. So, you know, President Trump is certainly not worrying about this. This isn't going to be a problem for a long time.
After the break, I'll ask Megan what she thinks will trigger the next recession. Stay with us.
And now, a word from a sponsor. A message from Morgan Stanley. Has alternative energy gone mainstream? Alternative energy, solar power investment, and utilities are taking what was once on the fringes of science as recently as 30 years ago and turning it into the new normal. Biosphere 2, a massive science facility tucked away in the desert foothills of the Santa Catalina Mountains, was built for controversial space exploration experiments. Now, it functions as a mainstream research facility, studying the potential for farming beneath solar panels, a technique that's already applicable for future colonies on Mars. Morgan Stanley's podcast discusses where the renewable energy industry has been, its transformations over the past few decades, and what this means for investors in renewable energy technology, as well as everyday consumers. Hear the full podcast at morganstanley.com/podcast and subscribe to the Morgan Stanley Ideas podcast. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, member SIPC.
A sort of fundamental question I have is the Trump economy really any different than the Obama economy? Obama hit 5.2% in one quarter, he hit 4% in multiple quarters, and always went back to, you know, this kind of trend line growth of around 2%, a little bit better than 2%. I think what you're saying is that, you know, the Trump economy will kind of do the same thing, even though he's taking a victory lap now. Obviously, tax policy is a little different with the tax cuts, and we actually decided to spend some money in Congress, which we didn't really do under Obama. But is the Trump economy fundamentally any different than the Obama economy?
So no, I would say it isn't fundamentally different. The picture for productivity growth or the labor supply looks the same. None of that has changed. I do think that the difference is that we've had a ton of fiscal stimulus come down the line, and that's goosing growth this year and next. It will be interesting to see what the administration does going into 2020, because most of this fiscal stimulus will peter out by then, and it's an election year. So there is a chance that the administration will re-up on fiscal stimulus and make this deficit and debt burden problem even worse. But, you know, not for a long time, so they might be willing to do that for re-election so that they can keep growth going. At some point, a lot of economists would argue that the economy would overheat if you do that. I mean, if you wrote down all of the economic indicators for the U.S. on a piece of paper and crossed out the name of the country and handed it to any decent economist and said, is this the country that desperately needs fiscal stimulus? No one would say yes. And so if we keep using that to stoke the economy at some point, we could cause the economy to overheat. The idea is you could get a late cycle surge in inflation. And if you did that, the Fed would be behind the curve and would have to catch up and would hike too rapidly and would pitch us into recession. I don't see any signs of a late cycle surge in inflation now. I think there are a lot of disinflationary factors in the economy offsetting some of the inflationary ones. But if we keep providing the same fiscal stimulus over and over again to constantly goose the system, we could get there.
On the Trump economy, I feel like it's two things at once. There's this, you know, supply side, growthy, do tax cuts for corporations, and then also obviously the fiscal stimulus. And then the kind of social policy comes into it with restrictive immigration policy and then Trump's fixation on trade deficits and putting on tariffs. So you have both tariffs and then restrictive immigration that would seem to, you know, offset the supply side. I mean, it just seems to me to be like this completely bifurcated policy with one side kind of canceling out the other. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah, I think that is a fair way to think about it. And I would add to that monetary policy, right? So you have these positive supply side shocks in terms of the tax bill and deregulation, offset by things like immigration and tariffs, which reduce our competitiveness. But then you also have a huge negative demand side shock for the U.S. economy, which is the Fed withdrawing monetary accommodation. So I'd say net, that picture looks more negative than positive, more than it just washing out if you consider all the policymakers.
Perfect segue into the Fed, which both of us watch very closely, and so does President Trump, as it happens. A lot of us thought that at the outset of this administration, eventually the president would criticize Jay Powell, the chairman of the Fed if he continued to raise interest rates. And he did exactly that in a recent interview and said he's not a fan of rate hikes and he thinks that Powell is trying to step on his great economy. You know, the Fed clearly has been on a path of very gradual rate hikes to, you know, get us back from the super low levels following the financial crisis. Did it surprise you when Trump publicly went after Jay Powell?
It didn't surprise me at all. This was pretty inevitable. The Fed is absolutely an independent institution. It is the most independent central bank I speak to. But that being said, the Fed does come under political pressure, not just from the administration, but from the media as well, being accused of, you know, causing an increase in inequality, stuff like that. So it doesn't surprise me that as the Fed, the FOMC is more hawkish this year than they were last year, as they continue to raise interest rates and take a slightly hawkish bent and essentially pour some cold water all over the fiscal stimulus programs that Trump has gotten through, that Trump has come out and said that he doesn't really like that. I do think he was a bit set up in that interview, though. I mean, he's a real estate guy. The thing he has going for him right now is the economy. So does he like high interest rates? Of course not. That's kind of the only answer he could give. And I don't think that Jay Powell or the Fed will really take these comments very seriously and feel under immense pressure just because of that. If it were a sustained attack, then I think they would feel under pressure. But I don't think that the administration would launch a more sustained attack unless the Fed got more hawkish. And I do think even though it's a more hawkish FOMC this year than last year, just because of rotations on the board and new people coming in, I do think that the Fed is concerned about inverting the yield curve. Even though publicly they'll say that a yield curve inversion doesn't necessarily mean we'll go into recession for a number of reasons. And there is a legitimate debate about that. But the reality is that investors believe that an inverted yield curve does predict a recession. And so, you know, even if it's not true this time, I think investors will make it a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the Fed is really worried about that. The yield curve is pretty flat. And so I think that they'll probably have to maintain a really gradual rate path because of that.
A couple other definitional issues. FOMC that Megan's referring to is the Federal Open Markets Committee. It's the group of Fed officials who make the decision on interest rates. And yield curve, a lot of people talk about the yield curve. Us in Wonk World love to talk about it. I'm sure that there are listeners who hear it all the time and don't necessarily know what it means. So give us the quick definition of what the yield curve is.
So the yield curve is looking at interest rates for bonds that mature at different times, so from short-term to long-term ones, and seeing what the differential is. So usually you look at short-term interest rates, like on two-year bonds, relative to longer-term interest rates, say on 10-year bonds. And the idea is that if 10-year bond yields are higher than 2-year bond yields, then that's okay. But the second that inverts and 10-year bond yields are lower than 2-year bond yields, that is a reflection of investor expectations about the U.S. economy. And so, therefore, investors get really worried. There are shifts in markets that push the U.S. economy into recession. That's the idea. That's how it's often worked. It's not like that universally. So in Canada and Japan, the yield curve really is no reflection on what economic growth will look like. And most of the rest of the world, it is, though. For a bunch of different reasons, like market structure that's changed so much this time, an inversion of the yield curve might not portend a recession. But the fact is, all investors have grown up understanding that an inversion of the yield curve equals a recession, so we'll probably make it happen anyhow.
All right, so we're overdue for a recession. Like, this has been a long expansion, really long expansion, albeit a slow and kind of unhappy one for the most part. One obvious way you get into the recession is what you talked about, the Fed having to play catch-up on inflation and bumping up interest rates a bunch of times. And then, you know, businesses slow down, consumers can't borrow as much and spend as much, and we get a recession. Is that what's going to happen, or is there something else on the horizon that could tip us over?
So that is certainly one of the risks, is a mistake in Fed policy and the Fed tightening too quickly and tipping us into recession. I don't think that's the most likely one, though. I think they say history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I think, like the last recession, this one will be caused by leverage. But it'll be a different kind of leverage than what we had last time around. So we're not looking at subprime loans, for example, this time. I think the issue this time around will probably be non-financial corporate debt. So our companies have been on a debt bonanza over the past year. And if you look at corporate debt relative to GDP, so relative to our economy, we're actually up at the levels that tipped us into recession in the past. So that's pretty worrisome. I think the reason that we're not being tipped into a recession is because interest rates are really low, so it's easy for these firms to go ahead and service this debt, but also because corporate profits are really high. The problem is that both those things are only going one way, so corporate profits are only going down from here, probably, and interest rates are really only going up from here, probably, and that will make it harder for firms to service their debt. If you look at leverage ratios for the S&P 500, so across the U.S. market, it actually, they don't look that high by historical standards, so we don't need to worry about it from that metric. But if you strip out all the huge cash-rich companies and tech and pharma who can use their cash to pay down debt, so they're in good shape, and look at smaller companies, actually, their leverage ratios are pretty high. And so, again, it's not an immediate issue because rates are so low and profits are so high, but I think that profits will be falling, rates will be rising, and that will make it much more difficult for a lot of these firms to service their debt. So that's certainly one risk. Coming from the U.S. as well, there are a couple of exogenous risks at all as well. So emerging market debt is a huge issue. The amount of emerging market debt that's been issued in U.S. dollars over the past 10 years has really exploded, and that's a problem as the U.S. dollar continues to get stronger. And I think it probably will do that. It will continue to appreciate for a little while. And so that puts a real squeeze on these emerging market countries that are trying to pay this debt down. In addition to that, they're invoicing a lot of their trade in U.S. dollars. And part of that is because oil is always denominated in U.S. dollar. But it's not just oil. A lot of their other trade is also invoiced in U.S. dollars. So again, as the U.S. dollar gets stronger, it's harder for them to afford that. So emerging market debt could be an issue. And then finally, I would highlight Italy as a real risk for the global economy. It's not my base case scenario, but the new Italian government is comprised of two parties, the Lega and the Five Star Movement, that are both deeply anti-European. And they've backed off of their previous calls to leave the euro. But they're set to blow out Italy's budget deficit. And if they go ahead and implement the policies to do that, Brussels could really crack down on them. And then I think there might be calls again for Italy to consider whether this European project is really in their best interests. And whereas the European project is really popular in most European countries, it's really not that popular in Italy. So you could imagine Italy actually choosing to leave the euro. It's the third largest economy in the Eurozone. It's got the fourth largest debt burden amongst developed countries. There would be massive defaults, lots of market volatility, and I think it would be a real existential threat for the European project. So I think that would have reverberations across the globe as well.
Two quick definitions out of that: leverage, just borrowed money, and exogenous, obviously outside the United States and our direct ability to control. All right, before we close, tell me the best thing you think Trump has done, if you can find one, and the worst thing that he's done.
So I think the deregulation piece is probably the best thing Trump has done. When you talk to business owners, it's all they can talk about. And, you know, in financial markets, we don't tend to focus on this as much. And I don't know why Trump isn't shouting it from the rooftops, but I think that's probably been the best thing he's done for business owners, particularly small business owners as well, which forms the backbone of our economy. But that's underestimated. It's a pretty big supply side shock on our economy. It makes it much easier for businesses to go ahead and provide goods and services. So that's the best thing he's done. The worst thing he's done, so many to choose from, but I would say probably trade. I think fundamentally these trade tiffs, especially between the U.S. and China, are about who is fundamentally going to be the global leader in machine learning and artificial intelligence. So the tariffs are kind of a sideshow way to needle at China. China has encapsulated this in its medium-term growth strategy and its long-term growth strategy, but in Made in China 2025, their medium-term growth strategy, they've said that they're going to subsidize high-tech industries. They're going to support them so that China can become a global leader. China plays a really long game policy-wise. The U.S. is mainly making policy by tweets, so we've got a much shorter time frame. But even so, we would also like to be the global leaders in machine learning and artificial intelligence. And so whatever happens on tariffs, I just don't see either one of us backing down on that. I think tariffs are a huge mistake in terms of how to address that. There are much smarter ways to have done it. But now that we've gone down this road, it's going to be hard to back down. And we saw what happened with Qualcomm a chip maker that needed Chinese approval and China wouldn't give it. That's an example of how quickly this will expand beyond trade into other areas. Anecdotally, if you talk to businesses, U.S. businesses trying to operate in China, they'll say that compliance and just getting goods onto ships has gone through the roof. So there are all kinds of ways that China can make it hard for U.S. companies to do business there that aren't announced and have nothing to do with tariffs, but they have got ways of retaliating that will affect the U.S. economy. So I think that's probably the worst thing that Trump has done.
Megan, we've covered it all. We've gone across the world. We've covered the Trump economy, the Fed, trade, all of this stuff, really incredible breadth. But the most important thing is your bullish case on the Red Sox. How confident are you in their World Series chances this year? They look unbeatable. I have to tell you, as a Yankee fan, that I watch the scores every night, keep expecting them to lose a damn game, and they don't do it. So are you just booking your World Series tickets now or what?
I am. I'm pretty bullish, and I have to say, when I attend a game in Fenway in person, they always win.
I would counter that by saying that Yankees also always win when I go to Yankee Stadium, particularly with my kids, so they always win. So if you go to all Red Sox games, I go to all Yankee games. I guess that means that the Red Sox win the AL East because they're up by 5.5 games, which drives me nuts. Anyway, Megan Green, thank you so much for joining Politico Money.
Thanks for having me.
And that's a wrap for this week's Politico Money. Thanks so much to Megan Green for joining us. Thanks to my producer, Ruth Morris. Our executive producer is Dave Shaw. If you're liking the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Rate us and write a written review. Helps other folks find us. We'll be back with you next week.